Okay, welcome back to the CBSSports.com College Basketball Podcast. We've got a special Tuesday edition here because it's the holiday season, and just like you love getting that one present on Christmas Eve, this is my Christmas Eve present to you. We'll still have a Wednesday, edition and a Friday edition, but we are having former guest Nate Silver of the New York Times, 538. You might have heard of him, you know, in the lead up to the election. Nate Silver is coming back on the podcast. Nate, it's great to have you. How you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm still recovering a little bit from the election. It's been almost 6 weeks now, I think, but still no rest for the weary. There's so much kind of aftermath and follow up and everything else. But I'm enjoying being able to be a sports fan again.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, it's great to have you come back to your roots. You were on a podcast last year. Then you know you made your rounds on the Daily Show and all the TV shows. It's good to see that you're circling back here to the podcast. It's great to have you home, so to speak. We'll get right into it. I'm bringing Nate on because fortunately he actually put his hand into the conference realignment bucket, if you will, and had a piece up on the New York Times on his blog, 538.blogs.nytimes.com, if you want to check it out, or just Google 538 and it'll lead you right there. And the post was titled "A Smart Breakaway for Big East Basketball Schools." And so here he was dealing with specifically the Catholic Seven, who at the time of his post hadn't officially broken away, but now over the weekend, those seven schools, Marquette, Georgetown, Villanova, Providence, DePaul, St. John's, Seton Hall, I think I got that right, all those seven, they're leaving. They're going to start a new league. But Nate, what was the premise of your post? You know, what information did you find, and what warranted you to step away from politics, you know, in the aftermath of the election and say, okay, I want to look at some college hoop stuff here?
So I guess the kind of politics and economics of college sports is a pretty interesting topic to me, really. But also as someone who has always been more of a kind of college basketball fan than a college football fan, seeing conferences have so little concern for the college basketball implications of the moves they were making. Maybe in some cases it improved the alignment incidentally, and in some cases it didn't. But to kind of see schools look after the basketball product and their brand and make a move that I think will ensure you're going to have a high-quality basketball game played almost every night in that conference, not just a good game, but also one where it makes some sense geographically, kind of culturally. To me, that's a positive move for college basketball, and to me it's a reminder that that you know, if a conference like the Big East is going to be as sloppy as it was about trying to weave together a football conference that made little sense, that there are stakeholders who have the opportunity to rebel against that process.
What were your takeaways? Why explain to listeners why it makes such economical and numerical sense for the Big East basketball schools to say, listen, we don't want to be beholden to football, and now is the right time?
So what we looked at is look at the long-term strength of a team, and I used the Sagarin ratings from USA Today. You could use a different rating system if you wanted. You'd probably get about the same conclusion. But what we found is that the seven breakaway schools have an average rating of about 81, which might be a meaningless number in the abstract, but generally speaking, all the power conferences have ratings on average above 80. So they're still those seven teams, the core of a big time college basketball conference. Probably not the ACC or the Big Ten, but on par with the other power conferences. The schools that were left in the Big East were getting weaker and weaker. However, they averaged about a 78, which is more the number you'd have associated with a strong mid-major. And of course, the better numbers within that group of football-playing schools are the teams like Connecticut, which sooner or later might wind up in the ACC, or the Big Ten, so you weaken it further. So if they want to preserve their status as playing in a top-tier basketball conference, they really had to make this move, or you might be in kind of a downward spiral where it kept getting weaker and weaker and really diluted the basketball product with a couple more moves away.
Now, you looked into the overall power using Sagarin. Could have gone with something like KenPom.com, as you said. You might have found something similar, or RPIs in recent years. What about, so this is just overall the strength of the teams. And if you want to remain a really good basketball team, you know, it would benefit them to start a new league. What about the other side of it, Nate, where you don't really touch on it in the piece? And I'm going to let you opine here, maybe, if you'd like to. The realist. realistic issue of TV money, why a lot of these schools will leave is because they feel they're going to get a better TV deal. Do you think there's going to be a correlation and a parallel where, you know, information like this, do you think maybe even TV executives might look at things like what you've written and what other people have written and said, listen, because of these teams' power numbers and what they've been over the past few years, not just that, but they're that ever-present, you know, footprint saying, do you think that should or will or has a factor into why these schools will leave?
I hope so. I think there are a lot of promises made about, well, if you kind of keep adding, you keep expanding the conference, then the better and better that you'll do. And, of course, history is starting to suggest otherwise. And if you're looking at college basketball ratings during the regular season, the question is, do you have a compelling matchup night in and night out? And there are two factors in that. One is the strength of the teams, obviously, but the other is the geographic and cultural affinity. I don't think the average Georgetown fan is going to get geared up by a game against Southern Methodist or Tulane or something like that, schools that are really about as opposite value-wise and frankly, in terms of the basketball performances you can get from a Georgetown or a Villanova. The original Big East was conceived with the idea that you're going to have teams in major urban markets, and up here I live in New York. It is more of a college basketball climate than a college football climate. And so you still have all these teams that have expanded with DePaul and so forth. They've expanded to the Midwest a little bit. All these teams basically are in major metropolitan areas. So that part of the deal still rings true. It still is an East Coast product. It still is a high average demographic base for the fans. And in fact, some of the schools they could add are also teams like Butler in Indianapolis and urban areas. I know Butler's Indianapolis is not New York or anything like that, but it still rings true the original kind of thesis of how the Big Ten, Big East rather, was conceived.
And yeah, I mean, certainly Indiana is a huge basketball state, and that drives a lot. It is interesting. Numbers were released on Monday. I think I saw Stuart Mandel of Sports Illustrated tweet them out that the New Mexico Bowl in football got like a 1.9, and Indiana Butler, which I think is the best game of the year so far, was a great game to watch. That only got a 1.5, and it was, you know, truthful numbers and unfortunate numbers to hear, but the reality of the matter is that you've got just an anonymous college bowl game yet again beating a basketball game in the ratings, and something like Indiana Butler, two national pro, like Butler isn't Indiana, it's not a power like even say Georgetown, it doesn't have all the history, but it's still a recognizable brand. I feel like Butler will bring more people to the TV set than it would, you know, 2, 4, even 6 years ago. I thought that was interesting, though, and I do wonder your opinion here. Now, you say you love college hoops more than college football. Do you think, you know, you did all this research looking at what conferences were good in the past 11 years based on Sagarin ratings and whatnot, but let's just jump 5 years in the future. Nate, do you think the health of college basketball will be better in 2017, 2018 than it is, you know, in 2011, 2012?
Well, you know, I think you still have a lot of long-term problems here in terms of kids leaving early, and in terms of, you know, you do almost wonder now if there's so many teams that make the tournament that if you've cheapened the regular season some. But, you know, remember, this Big East concept worked really well before it was a football conference, and it was the conference that that other leagues wanted to emulate potentially. But you know, college basketball in the regular season is not going to be college football, I don't think. It's just not. People just aren't quite as fanatical about it in the entire region of the country. I mean, college football is basically really heavily concentrated in the South and Midwest, where two of the four kind of regions in the country are just religious about that, and basketball has always been a little bit more of a specialty product. And so, you know, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture here. At the same time, you almost can flip that and say, well, college basketball fans are a discerning audience, where they know during the regular season, I should say, in particular, where they know quality. They know when they're getting a matchup that's not compelling whatsoever. And the threshold to have someone turn in to watch a regular season game is unfortunately higher than you might want. But you do have to have these marquee matches. By the way, another thing, too, about with the Big East is is describing is they might have a 10-team league. And what's attractive about that is that everyone can play everyone else, a true round robin. You get the home and home every year. And so you build up these rivalries over time. You start with a group of seven, maybe add three more. And so I think they're doing things almost in kind of a hipsterish kind of way, I guess, right, where you market to your fans and your loyal fans. You're not going to have the drive-by viewing for a regular season college basketball game that you would for a college football bowl or something like that. But it does preserve, I think, the integrity of the conference.
And there's something to be said for preserving that. I do think at certain times, while it is an issue an issue for conference commissioners and ADs and presidents and whatever you want to say, like if college basketball isn't getting certain kind of ratings and it's not driving certain ads, and I get why the business end of that is a legitimate concern, but I got to be honest, I love the fact that the Catholics haven't broke away, because as you're saying, there seems to be a true basketball interest here, and almost in an oh by the way avenue of doing things, doing it like this will, I think, improve college basketball. And while the ratings are never going to be what college football is, Nate, I do think that you're still going to be able to create a great product for college hoops. And in doing that, I just think you're going to have another conference with a decent TV deal. It's still going to have ratings that are about the same, if not a little better, because it's going to create better non-conference matchups. But I wanted to ask you this, because I've seen it floated out there a couple times.
Sure.
Let's say, okay, so you got these seven and breaking away. Let's say they get up to 10, right? Okay, and 10, I totally agree. Round robin would be perfect. For college basketball peers should root for this new league to be a 10-team league, true round robin, everyone plays each other twice. I think it would be fantastic. But let's say, you know, Greed takes over once again and they aren't settled with 10 and they want 12, and Cincinnati and UConn come knocking. Should the new to-be-named league, even if it's only, let's say they're even upfront about it and they're saying, you know, this might be a 3-year, 5-year arrangement, should they take Cincy and UConn, even though those teams have football programs as well, or should they kind of stay pat and say, no, we want basketball only? What do you think they should do in that case, if it
were
to happen?
Well, I think you have to have a sliding scale here, right? Where if you look at the Big Ten, for example, I was a fan. I grew up in East Lansing, Michigan. I was a fan of the expansion to include Nebraska and Penn State because they're such premier programs that, okay, that kind of outweighs everything else. Whereas I didn't see the rationale for adding Rutgers or Maryland. I think the question you want to ask is now, let's say you do have a pretty strong product. So not only would the new additions to UConn, would they not fit in, but would they really bring the average up as far as both quality of play and TV sets tuned in? And I think UConn certainly is a premier program that would do that. And maybe part of the strategy here is we almost have a better chance to keep UConn if we break away than if we stay, right? Yeah. They might wind up with the ACC, or they might wind up with the Big Ten. But frankly, they could play as a football independent if they had to, and play in this conference for a couple of years. So I think you would want a long-term commitment, not just a near-term flirtation. But I do think you'll have a lot of people knocking on the doors of this conference, and they ought to have a high standard. They should pick their three. If they're expanding only to 10, they should pick those three pretty carefully. But it will be kind of the premier non-football college basketball league. You could almost do it. I thought it would be fun to have a college conference organized like they do soccer in England, where you can have like a second division or something, right? Where maybe
a
couple teams that if DePaul can't get its act together, they get relegated to the second tier.
Oh boy, yes. There's a hashtag on Twitter, CBBCL, the College Basketball Champions League, is what it's referred to as. And you are right in the wheelhouse of a few podcast listeners who have engaged. We've actually had a podcast dedicated to a theoretical. We're going so niche right now, Nate. But yeah, I'm telling you, it would never happen in college, but if it did, I mean, can you imagine how must-watch it would be?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about a case like that, where if you really had night in, night out, an elite college basketball conference where winning the regular season really meant something. By the way, I do think these conference tournaments, I love the NCAA tournaments, I'm not going to complain about that too much, but I do think the conference tournaments can dilute the regular season a little bit. But if you really had a premier matchup night in and night out, then that would be quite something.
Yeah, for anyone listening and got to this podcast by way of CBSSports.com, what I'll do is I'll link our good friend John Infante, who used to work in compliance with the NCAA, knows all about how these things work. He penned something for my independent site, College Hoops Journal, back in the day, basically depicting how a soccer-style college basketball arrangement would work. It is, if you allow yourself to go down the rabbit hole and even just dream that dream, it's a really interesting watch. Before we get to the national tour that was Nate Silver amid the election, one more quick college thing. You mentioned you weren't in favor of Rutgers and Maryland to the Big Ten. Can I have you expound on that real quick, Nate?
Well, you know, I think this is also a case where are you improving the quality of the average football game, for that matter, basketball game played on typical weekend? I think it really is that the strength of the matchup in terms of, do you have fans traveling? Do you have the history? Obviously, not if you're adding new teams, but is there a compelling reason to make those matchups happen? I think the average fan that grew up in East Lansing, Michigan, has no interest whatsoever in seeing Michigan State play Rutgers, really. Or Maryland, at least, is a better college basketball program, at least over time. But that is not a compelling matchup on paper, not when people are going to travel to as much. You know, also, I think these teams don't realize that you know, I live in New York. I don't really have many conversations about Rutgers sports, right? And I grew up in a college town where you know, everyone eats, lives and breathes this stuff. But in the New York region, college football is just not a big deal at all. If you're a Rutgers alum, then you care about it, and that's probably about it. So I think they said, well, you expand into the New York market, you get on Time Warner Cable here or whatever, but you get like a 0.002 rating or something, and it doesn't really help you all that much. I think part of it is the Big Ten network is hoping they can get more fees, but they're kind of assuming that the cable companies don't know how to value this product properly. I think there are a lot of reasons. I mean, frankly, you could sell the Big Ten network here, but just based on all the Big Ten alums in New York. But the average Big Ten alum in New York probably would rather see Michigan State play a game against, say, Wisconsin instead of against a Rutgers or a Maryland, I think.
All right, good deal. Again, you can read Nate's thoughts on the breakaway for the Big East basketball schools at 538 on his blog on the New York Times website. Now, let's get to – so as – you know, it's interesting. As the election is building up, you become – we're getting some Nate Silver behind the scenes here. I want to know what it was like to basically, I mean, this wasn't your first go around, right? I mean, you had the track record of 08, and I found it interesting how some people, you know, you got lampooned famously by Joe Scarborough, I believe, right? And your popularity kept growing, I guess, because more and more people were doubting the information you were putting out there. So can you basically take us into your head as, you know, August, September, October, as these months are rolling along and you're getting more requests for whether it was, you know, media interviews in any kind of way, some, you know, I can't even imagine what your Twitter mentions look like. I mean, I don't even know if you were like, I can't look at my at mentions right now. What was it like, you know, let's stop it on the night of election. Up to that point, what was it like for you?
Yeah, I mean, there was a point at which I couldn't check my own, like, Twitter feed. Actually, for a while, I couldn't check the at mentions, right?
Yeah.
And then I couldn't check just Twitter at all at one point, because I'm not super shy about doing media stuff, but I'm a little bashful, and I don't want to get too distracted. Actually, one of the cliches you always hear from athletes they're preparing for the Super Bowl or some big game, they're like, well, I'm just trying to concentrate on practice and block all these distractions out, right? And it always seems like a BS excuse, but it's kind of true. If you're really, really busy with stuff, when I was working probably 100-hour weeks, I had a book called The Signal of Noise that came out that was promoting at the same time the election was occurring. So you really don't have time to stop and sit down and contemplate both the negative and the positive attention. And focusing on your job is the way to, do I think, ultimately satisfy your fans and shut up your critics. So when the election was over, it felt pretty good, and we got 50 out of 50 states, right, with a bit of a bit of luck on a couple of them. But it really is like you get so caught up in something, and that kind of takes over, you know, and there's only so much that anyone can do and process in a day, and so, you know, it kind of helps you to forget some of the stuff and just concentrate on what you know how to do best.
Yes, I'm going to allow you to do another. I was going to plug it near the end, but you brought it up, so we're going to do it right now. So you do have a book out called The Signal and the Noise. I have not read it yet. I did ask for it for Christmas, I swear, and I hope I get it. If I don't get it, then I'm just going to be like, I'm buying it on Amazon that night. But take me through this pitch one more time here. What, first of all, what is the book about, obviously, but when were you like, you know what, I need to, and I know I can make a book out of this.
So the book is about about prediction, and it does talk a little bit about political prediction, and kind of in an odd way was very prescient for what would wind up occurring this year, where people get so lost in the BS, and pundits so want to tell the narrative about how the campaign is going, and they're ignoring fairly basic facts. In this case, just that Obama was up in Ohio and other states that gave him the lead in the Electoral College pretty much from wire to wire. But I also look at sports, and in sports, obviously, with the we retell the story of Moneyball, which vindicates the scouts actually in some ways, but still the success you've seen in baseball, it seems becoming more analytical and more data driven, just kind of making better decisions about how to run a team. People think, oh, it's a great story. It must be happening everywhere in the age of big data. And it's not really, it's not happening in political coverage, although it is on some campaigns, certainly. It's not happening if you look at things like earthquakes. So really the heroes of the book wind up being basically baseball teams and sports gamblers. So there's a good mix of content, but trying to kind of parse through, we have all this information, all this data today, and what characterizes people in industries where they're having success and being smarter and more data driven. And it does get to the institutional cultures a lot as well, where the good thing about sports is that you play games and baseball every day and college basketball a couple of times a week. So you can participate as much as you want, but ultimately you're tested by your results. Unfortunately, many other walks of life either have elections where you only have one trial, so to speak, every 4 years, or it's so fuzzy how you evaluate things, we don't show as much improvement. So it's kind of a both an inspirational tale and a cautionary tale, I guess, at once about how we use all the data, all the stats in the world today.
I'm always fascinated by how long it takes to write a book. How long, you know, from first word on Microsoft Word or whatever you used to sending the final draft, how long did that take?
So a bit more than basically three years.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a long, but I did have another job at the time, but probably it was a year and a half of real work, I would say. Doing a book is if you're used to instant gratification blogging kind of thing and the occasional magazine piece or whatever else, then it's just very different where you have something which you're keeping to yourself and your editor for a long time. And I think it's actually a helpful thing to do where you have to refine your thought process and keep making it better and better and kind of craft it and sculpt it into something. Using that part of your brain is something we don't do very much anymore, and it really gives you a chance to step back and forces you to see the big picture. So I didn't expect the book to take 3 years, but it was important to do it right, and it becomes a labor of love. It's not the kind of thing where I have to get this blog post out because I'm on deadline. It's more like, let's really do this right. If you're going to do a book, take that much time out of your life, you should do it right. I think you have something which can be can have an impact, and you can refer back to as part of the overall approach and argument you're making about your field of study.
All right. Now, I'm circling back to the election stuff. So what was Nate Silver doing on the night of the election? Are you at your desk where you're talking to me right now, surrounded by coworkers and you know, 8-foot-high stacks of paper and juggling between three different kind of computers? And after it was over, and I don't remember when they called it for Obama, I want to know if you went right home, if you went to a bar for a celebratory drink and been like, 50 for 50, bitches. Like, what? Take me back. Come on. Everyone wants to hear it. How'd it go down?
So the night before the election, I was actually up all night, partly out of kind of nervous energy, but also we were trying to design a model where it updated the odds in real time. And so that was a kind of around the clock project. So it was so busy, I didn't have time to do it. So, and I finally thought I had finished it about half an hour before the polls closed in Kentucky, where they closed first. And then I ran on the first state, and it said, oh, Obama's going to win for sure. He'll win by 4 points nationally. I thought that can't be right. It's much too confident, which turned out to be the result pretty much. So I spent all night doing this project, and we wound up mothballing because we weren't confident enough in it. And that made me kind of delirious all of election night. But the election nights themselves are kind of oddly quiet in some ways, right? Where everyone from the campaigns to journalists to voters just kind of waiting for the results to come in. I think in the end it's like, well, you know, we've been building this up for for really a year and a half from when the primary campaign heated up in 2011. And so, you know, why not just wait for for another hour or two to make things kind of official? And so I was trying not to overdo things too much on election night. I didn't want to preempt the New York Times and make a call before they did, given the history, I guess, of this country in Florida and so forth in 2000 and making calls that turned out to be wrong, right?
Yep.
And so I kind of wound up being cautious and just being kind of very deliberate in how I was going about doing things, because there's just too much going on really on election nights to do it any other way. Almost you can't keep up even if you tried. So you know, I just kind of relaxed, and I did have a beer afterward at about 2:30 in the morning. Fortunately, bar close in New York is 4, but I was mostly just exhausted. You know, it was more like there was no like woohoo moment. It was just kind of utter exhaustion. Kind of if you're running a marathon or something, this was kind of like with the book coming out in the same year. It was kind of a nerd marathon, I guess. And you just kind of collapse at the finish, right? The person who wins the Boston Marathon doesn't go out and celebrating, right, and running like a victory lap. It's kind of like you're just tired, and you're glad it's over, and you're glad it went well. But you kind of, you know, I feel like I'm talking in sports cliches, right? Well, you leave 110% out on the field, win or lose. But it had gotten to the point where, with the long hours especially, it was physically draining as well as mentally draining. So that was, you know, about it. One beer was all I could handle.
Oh, wow. Look at that. Now, you went on Daily Show. You did Colbert, too, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So just a couple quick things here. I mean, one, do you have friends from high school that are like, what on earth, man? Like anyone, not even friends, but just like jackasses from sophomore year that have found you again and just can't believe that you've made your way onto these shows. And also, what's it like to go on those shows? What were you thinking? Were you like, I can't even believe what's happening right now. I mean, I know you had a book to plug, and that was the primary thing. But you also, I mean, listen, it dovetailed nicely with the fact that you'd become the de facto media, superstar. The hashtags out there that, I mean, did you see your Nate Silver, Chuck Norris type hashtag? I mean, it got to these ridiculous levels, man.
I'm aware of all of my friends make sure to fill me in on, especially if there's anything embarrassing, right? Then make sure that hits my inbox a lot. But you know, I think part of it is you kind of have to, if you're on a show like that and you're in front of a live audience, you just kind of have to go with it, right? You kind of have to put yourself in the moment and not get too psyched out about it. By the way, practice does help. I think I've improved from like a C minus TV guest to like a B plus or B, you know, just by kind of doing it a lot more frequently in the run to the election and promoting the book and so on and so forth. I think also if you're on one of these programs, if anyone out there is on one day, then you really do want to let your personality show a little bit. Hopefully you have a personality that people don't dislike. But you know, the host is wanting you to roll with the punches a little bit, right? And it shouldn't be the fifth degree where you're just kind of answering things in as efficient a fashion as possible. You want to show off your sense of humor a little bit and just kind of actually have some fun. If you show up and you want to be there and you say, I want to have fun and it's not the last TV interview I'll do, then you'll do a lot better than if you're kind of intimidated by the circumstances, obviously.
How about that? And now, you know, we're approaching Christmas. I assume you got a nice little vacation there, but you've been able to decompress. Has life, you know, drifted mostly back to normal at this point, Nate?
There are a lot more like meetings.
Okay.
Things, right? You get to meet with people want to meet you or you want to meet them, and so my whole life is now just a series of like lunch meetings.
How about that?
Basically.
I think that's a quasi humble brag. And secondly, when was the first time? I know you know this. When was the first time someone actually stopped you and said, "Are you Nate Silver?" Because that has to have happened, right?
It happened occasionally in Chicago in 2008.
Okay.
But like it happened. I mean, now it's died down a little bit. But like I was waiting for a cab because I was late to the airport because I'm always late for everything pretty much. And there were like two people like waiting for a cab next to me who both independently recognized me. I think they actually let me take a cab right in front of them since they were probably there first. So you know, it was a nice little perk. But it happened. More than you would think. I've gotten like free drinks and free appetizers and things like that. Sometimes gotten things where people want to pose for photos. So you know, hopefully that will that will wear off to some extent. But it is pressure, right? It's like you're going to the airport or something, right? You have to feel like you almost have to dress up or something, right?
I don't know what you're talking about, Nate, but yes, I'm sure.
Well, I don't know. It's, you know, no, if you're out there in the public, if you're out there in the public eye, I got actually got recognized. I was in Atlantic City last weekend playing. I'd been in a poker tournament and busted out. So what do you do when you bust out a poker tournament? It's 3 in the morning. Well, you play drunken blackjack, right?
Yeah.
But I got recognized playing blackjack at like 3 in the morning at Resorts Atlantic City or something, which was like, oh, I thought that was my one.
That is
one
awesome.
Refuge, right? And there you go. But the guy was very nice. So, you know, so you roll with the punches, I guess.
Nate Silver playing drunken blackjack in Atlantic City. The podcast has actually gone there. That is fantastic. Because, you know, you mentioned when you're on The Daily Show about how you had a poker past, and that's really how, you know, a lot of this stuff kind of came to be, because you looked at odds and what was really the scientific approach to it. So my question to you with this, just quickly, we'll wrap up here. This is a lot of fun, though. I'm enjoying it. With blackjack and stuff, right, it's all about, you know, knowing the odds and all that good stuff. So do you prefer drunken blackjack, or are you still more of a poker guy, even though obviously the fundamentals of both can be similar with the math?
Well, see, poker, I still approach it as though it was my job for a couple of years, or one of my jobs. I still approach it like it's work, right? Which doesn't mean it can't be fun. I mean, work can be fun, but when I played poker, I always would play blackjack, because you don't really have to think. You know, most decisions you kind of memorize basic strategy. I'm not trying to count cards or anything like that, and so it's a way to kind of goof off and relax a little bit. But I'm trying to take the poker thing pretty seriously. I'm going down to Australia to play in the Aussie Millions in January. Yeah, it's you know, I talked to guys like, well, you know, you should come to Australia. They have the Aussie Open, and they have beaches, and they have poker at the same time, and so it's kind of a good combination.
Yes, that's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't that hard to sell, right? Like, oh, if you bust out a term, you can go watch the Aussie Open. I'm like, okay, you know, it seems like kind of a no-lose proposition. I'm probably playing the World Series of Poker this summer in Vegas. But by the way, I think that is, you know, I've certainly had nothing quite like this election before, but you do have to, in poker, make a lot of decisions where at least you have a lot on the line financially under kind of constant pressure, right? And you also understand that, you know, the hand, not to tell a bad beat story, because it's very standard, right? But in Atlantic City, you know, you have pair of kings, and you get on before the flop against ace-king, you're a 70% favorite, and, you know, and you're going to lose 30% of the time, right? And I lost this particular hand as a favorite, and that happens all the time, right? So you understand that, you know, I'm a big believer in hard work, but you understand that you can do as best as you can. There's still a little bit of luck and kind of variance, I guess, on top of that. And you know, I think I've run well, as Poker Player would put it, in my life, and been pretty fortunate in cases where I had a lot on the line. Again, hard work is a part of it, but I think that's kind of why you have to be a little bit humble about it, because I had a very good run through in 2008 to 2012, and if I crashed and burned in the election, well, you know, I still think I'm someone who has been fortunate in my life overall. So it gives you a little bit more perspective on things, I think.
A bad beat story from Silver. That's great. Bad beat stories, and you won't believe how I lost in fantasy football on Monday Night Football. I mean, these are just, you just can't hear enough of these, you know?
I have one of those stories too, man.
Oh.
I don't know if I should. This is the ultimate in self-indulgence.
We all have the, you know, I fell prey to the poker craze when I, in my later years in college, my junior and senior year, back, you know, 03, 04, whatever it was when it became popular, we would play, and there was this one guy in the group who we never really let him know, but he was like, he would love telling you his bad beat stories, and no one like had the heart to just be like, dude, we don't care. We know, man. You got beat on the river. Let me guess. You lost on the river this time. Okay.
You won't believe this. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, there is the friend who always tells you the bad beat stories, and the friend who always tells you about how awesome he played. I'm not sure which is more.
Yeah.
I think the bad beat's actually more annoying for some reason. Right?
Yes.
I think it's actually worse, right?
Yeah.
It's like annoying and depressing at the end too, right? And usually the bad beat stories are usually, you know, often people think they're a bad beat and they actually played the hand really bad, right? This one was simple. My bad beat, at least, you know, it's before the flop, so you can't. It's fairly straightforward. You're going to get in with a pair of kings, but you know, a lot of times these things are actually fairly questionable, right? Where someone makes a bad decision on the flop, say, and then they catch a lucky card on the turn, right? And then somebody else catches a luckier card in the river, and they're like, oh, it was a bad beat. It's like, actually, you know, it was kind of a restoration of justice,
yeah,
really, right? Where,
yeah,
you played, you know, you shouldn't have been ahead to begin with, right? So it kind of, you know, it was justice was being served there, actually. You didn't get a bad beat. But there's so many ways. It's actually why people in poker can fool themselves, is there's so many different ways to get lucky or unlucky. You always have some kind of an excuse, right? It's lucky to be dealt a pair of kings until someone else makes a better hand or someone else has a pair of aces, and it's very unlucky to have that hand in that deal. And so poker players are good at making excuses for themselves, but the best ones, I think, don't give themselves too much rope. Or yeah, if it's a clear situation, then that's fine. But if you really hung up on your bad beat stories, because you're going to have a bad beat once, but if your whole life is a bad beat story, then you might be kind of the common denominator.
Exactly.
After too long.
Well, maybe one day down the road we can share a blackjack table or something. I'm not a huge blackjack guy. I've played a couple times, and I've learned on when to hit and when to stay and the odds on that. But one time, my colleagues Gary Parrish and Jeff Goodman were with me at a Vegas table, and I hit when I shouldn't have, and I caused someone else to bust and lose a lot of money. And the guy wanted to kill me, and I didn't realize that I had done wrong there, because I kind of just sat down and I was like, you know, just playing the odds on face value there, without truly, you know, having read the books on here's what you should do, and it's all, you know, here's what the book, they actually say, the dealer will say the book tells you to hit, or the book tells you to stay, or the book tells you to split, or whatever. And so I've learned. So maybe one day I'd love nothing more to share a blackjack table at 3 a.m. with a drunken Nate Silver while people come up to you with their TI-84s and are like, can we get a photo? That would be the nexus of the universe there. But you can follow Nate on Twitter, twitter.com at 538. That is spelled out 538. So be sure to do that. Hey, you're a champ, man. This was a great podcast, kind of out of the blue. I can't thank you enough. I appreciate it so much. And maybe as we get closer to the tournament and you do some more blogging about selections and whatnot, we can circle back around, right?
Of course. Thank you.